You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's year end, a time when linguists and lexicographers decide and debate which words have emerged as a force over the previous 12 months. From vape to Ebola, from ISIS to spornosexual, words define a year even as they are created or made popular by events in that year. So while we may debate what came first, the selfie stick or the culture of narcissism, it's clear that both are here to stay, at least until 2015. Ben Zimmer, the Wall Street Journal's language columnist, joins us now to talk about the year in language. Mr. Zimmer, who's also the executive producer of Vocabulary.com, was given the Linguistics Society's first Linguistics Journalism Award in 2014. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Hi, Leonard. Always a pleasure.
And congratulations on that award.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, the Linguistics Journalism Award, which is a new award, and it's just great that linguistically informed journalism is being recognized now, and there's more of it out there, so it's great to see.
It's also nice to be the first one.
How
did 2014 shape up in terms of words?
Well, it was a mixed bag, I would say. There were no words, I think, that when we look at what might be a Word of the Year candidate for the American Dialect Society, there isn't a single word that sticks out that, you know, this must be the word that sums up the zeitgeist. But, you know, as always, there's a very interesting array of words that we can talk about, words that were either new or newly prominent over the past year. Some had to do with current events, politics, there were big news stories like Ebola and ISIS, for instance, that dictated the way that we talked about things, but also a lot of creativity, especially with online culture and tech innovations and that sort of thing.
But nothing as definitive as Occupy from 2011 or Bailout from 2008, nothing from technology as solid as Tweet from 2009 or Hashtag from 2012. What kinds of cultural circumstances make for good language development?
Well, you know, what we're looking for, again, it doesn't necessarily have to be a new word. It can be an older word that's used in innovative ways or in interesting new contexts. So, for instance, you mentioned Occupy as a big word in 2011. Obviously, that's an old word. But thanks to the Occupy movement, people were using that word in lots of, you know, very interesting ways. We actually saw that with an interesting choice for Word of the Year just last year for 2013, when the American Dialect Society selected the word because, which could be used in new ways preceding a noun, for instance, because science, or before an adjective or before an interjection, and you know, it was a way of taking a new word and putting taking an old word, I should say, and putting a new spin on it can often attract the attention of linguists and lexicographers.
And a favorite of yours for this year is vortex, which originated in Dickens' lifetime.
Well, the polar vortex is what we're most familiar with from this year. The word vortex itself is very old, and as I discovered, polar vortex actually goes back to the Dickensian era. 1853, I believe, was the first time that phrase was used in a magazine that Dickens himself edited. But what's interesting, I think, about that word is that you do have the phrase polar vortex, this weather term that everybody has learned this year. Some people would say that it's being misused and overapplied, but then we see it being used even on its own just as vortex, so that L.L. Bean is able to advertise vortex-proof gear. And I see vortex being used in all sorts of very interesting ways. You know, Jeb Bush talks about getting sucked into the vortex of the presidential race. So it's a very evocative word, and I think people were having a lot of fun with it this year.
Although 2014 pales beside 1914, which brought us air raid, balkanization, doohickey, trench coat, legalese, gesundheit, oy vey, tuches, backpack, big screen, and crossword. Was that the greatest year in word accumulation during the 20th century?
That was a good year for it. Yeah, there was a Boston Globe column recently that sort of rounded up all the words that first appeared in 1914, and there were some great ones there. That's true. You know, but it's very hard to tell when you're in it what the great words are going to be. You know, in 100 years, what will we see when we look back on 2014 decide? You know, well, this was the year of the such and such. You know, the bud tender, for instance. Someone who works at a cannabis dispensary, which we're hearing in from places like Colorado and Washington, where marijuana has been legalized. Who knows really what will have staying power? It's very difficult to know when you're in the moment.
Although those words from 1914 have all had staying power, I'm sure there were other words from that year that we have since forgotten. What are the criteria for word making your short list? Are you looking for longevity or words with staying power?
Not necessarily. I mean, very often it can just be something that sort of sums up the year and what we were thinking about, what we were talking about. Sometimes you can tell right away that words are not going to have staying power because they are so tied to the events of the year. You know, when everybody was talking about this bipartisan spending bill that had to pass Congress so that there wouldn't be a government shutdown, a new word popped up, which was a mashup of CR for continuing resolution and Omnibus becoming the Cromnibus, which some people likened it to the cronut, which we all remember as the croissant donut hybrid. So will the word Cromnibus be entering dictionaries and so forth? I doubt it. It was very much tied to that particular political moment. But it certainly says something about, the types of issues we were talking about in the past year.
And then there's another word like that, plastiglomerate.
Right, that's an interesting one, and we may actually see that one entering dictionaries eventually. So that happened this year when researchers reported that on the beaches of Hawaii you could find this new kind of stone, which was really formed from melted plastic, sediment that you would find on the beach, organic debris, creating this new form that they dubbed plastiglomerate. And because that shows how clearly humans are making an impact on the geological record, I have a feeling that that's a word that people will be talking about because, you know, it's a kind of a permanent mark of humans on the Earth in that way.
Sad as it is.
Yeah.
Both Dian and Ebola, terms from another time, that have become relevant again. So it's part of the natural cycle of words that they appear and disappear?
It can very well turn out that way. I mean, with a term like die-in, yeah, I mean, that's gone through many cycles going back to Earth Day 1970, the very first die-in as a form of protest, which, of course, was modeled on the sit-in from the civil rights movement and various other protests that take the form of a word plus in, like teach-in and so forth. The die-in from 1970 then became prominent in Vietnam War protests and then much later on in anti-war protests involving Iraq. It was prominent in AIDS activism in the late 80s. And this year, of course, with the grand juries failing to indict the police officers in the cases of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, the die-in became a very, very powerful form of protest, and we had many powerful words coming out of those protests too, very often in the form of slogans, which would not count as words of the year since they're more like complete sentences, like hands up, don't shoot, or I can't breathe.
And you've written a column for Wired magazine explaining why I can't breathe is your phrase of the year. Why is it so effective?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a visceral power to that because, so many of us actually watched the video of Eric Garner's dying moments where he kept repeating that phrase over and over again. And so it's very much tied to that moment, that sort of heart-crushing moment there. At the same time, it turns outwards and becomes a statement that has been used by demonstrators to talk about the sort of the greater social issues and racial injustices, so that it takes on this kind of metaphorical power as well. And so being so tied to the sort of the physicality of Eric Garner dying, and then the kind of the social movement that surrounds that, and Ferguson and other other cases, I think, is what really made it so powerful. And it was named Quotation of the Year by Fred Shapiro, the editor of Yale Book of Quotations.
It is interesting that the form dates back to the movie Spartacus.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about that pronoun I being used as a kind of a pronoun of solidarity, a kind of a rallying together where everyone can identify with an oppressed subject, then that figure of Spartacus, where everyone sort of protects him by saying I am Spartacus, in a sense, as even though it's a fictional moment, it's something that is a way of that pronoun itself has kind of developed its sense of sort of solidarity and also empathy with a figure that's oppressed.
I'm talking with Ben Zimmer, the Wall Street Journal's language columnist, about the words of the last year, although many of these words are not new. Is slacktivism a new word?
Slacktivism, I think that's been around for a few years. I'm trying to remember if we talked about it in a previous Word of the Year vote. I believe it's been around, actually just checking quickly, from 1995. So it has been around for a while. But I think it helps to describe a lot of what's also been called hashtag activism, where you can just in a kind of a facile way latch on to a particular cause by using a hashtag on Twitter. You're not really committing yourself to anything, although you're presenting yourself as a socially aware individual.
Now, there are some things that actually compete to describe the same thing. For example, we have ISIS and ISIL, and then Islamic State.
That's right, and there are many many terms that are being used to describe this group, the Islamic State, and many Europeans actually prefer to use the Arabic label Daesh, which comes from sort of an acronym formed in Arabic, which the group itself dislikes, and so instead of sort of giving them a kind of a power of calling themselves the Islamic State when so many Muslims disagree that this is some sort of new caliphate that they are putting forward, why not use a label that they dislike in order to name them? And they're still, at the end of the year, we don't really have any consensus on what to call them.
And then everybody was calling them ISIS, and then the president started calling them ISIL, and then most of the people in government started calling them ISIL.
That's right.
In the end, for someone like me, I find the whole thing confusing. I don't know whether to say ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State. But ISIS was their term, wasn't it, before they decided calling themselves the Islamic State?
Well, it depends how you translate it into English, whether it's the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria or Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So that's where the L creeps in, how you form the acronym that way. They're just different interpretations of the original Arabic expression. But either way, it posits that there actually is an Islamic State or a would-be Islamic State. And so to cut them down to size, many people would prefer this other label, Daesh, which is a more disparaging term.
But we don't do that in this country.
I think John Kerry used it once, but I think he was in Europe at the time, so he might have been playing to a European audience when he used it.
People have been writing in some questions about words that they wonder about, although none of them seem to be from this year, particularly like another. Somebody wants to know where another comes from. Another person wants to know why politicians started using the word calculus in terms of political calculus. When we come back, maybe we'll address those and some of the other words that have come along this year. I like anonymous and GAFA. And manspreading sure has become a word in the news in the last week or so. My guest is Ben Zimmer, who writes the Wall Street Journal's language column. He is also executive producer of vocabulary.com. And we will continue our conversation after this. Later on in the show, psychologist Ron Friedman talks about what factors make for a happy work environment and offers some tips for solving conflicts at the office. And the amazing Kreskin talks about making predictions for the coming year. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. We're back with Ben Zimmer, the Wall Street Journal's language columnist, and we're talking about the words of the past year. We invite your nominations. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And handle, there's another word that had a totally different meaning until very recently. Has your profession changed, Ben? We used to think of linguists as defenders of the status quo in languages, as vigilant gatekeepers. Are they now more permissive, more inclusive?
Well, I'm not sure if gatekeepers was ever an apt description of what linguists do. There's a much longer tradition of descriptive linguistics and descriptive lexicography, which seeks to describe the language as it really is rather than as it should be. Now, certainly there are those who write about language in a more prescriptive fashion, and there's always a bit of a tension between those two approaches of descriptivism and prescriptivism. But I think that interesting balance can be found between those two approaches. You can look at, for instance, Steven Pinker's new book, Sense of Style, which is a kind of a linguistically enlightened style guide, as an example of the way that people with a background in linguistics can still talk about the way that language can be used in the for clarity and so that there's less confusion without upholding prescriptive rules that we learn in school and then never really remember how they work.
So, should I assume you don't secretly dream of coining a word?
Oh, coining words is that. I mean, that's something that just shows the sort of the innovation in language. I enjoy sort of making up new words, but I haven't had any that have really caught on in a serious way. But I also like to stand back and observe and see how they develop without sort of taking a role in it myself. So but I mean, all of it shows how anyone really, whether you're a professional observer of the language or an amateur, can be involved with the creation of language.
An old girlfriend put down pedantic people by calling them infomaniacs, but that didn't catch on. Can we sometimes kind of hurt a word by accepting it? For example, ain't took a long time to get into the dictionary, but is it my imagination that since ain't was incorporated into the acceptable body of English, it's kind of fallen out of favor?
Well, whether a word like ain't actually is recognized in a dictionary, I don't think has all that much to do with the actual usage of people in colloquial speech. There was much to do about ain't being recognized in Webster's New International Dictionary, the third edition, which was published in the early 1960s, even though they had already included ain't in their previous edition in the 1930s. But what happened in the 60s, it was seen that dictionaries were being more permissive by not strictly stating that this is an improper word. But again, if you're just taking that descriptive approach and recognizing that, yes, ain't is informal, colloquial, often showing up in regional dialects and so forth, then there's no point in simply dismissing it or ignoring it. You have to actually explain the way people use language in the real world.
I understand that the Oxford dictionaries have chosen the word vape as their word of the year. Was that word even on your list of nominees?
I actually had included it in a previous year, I believe, a year or two ago. So it was something. It's something that's been on my radar, this term for using an e-cigarette. This is something that the folks at Oxford have recognized as a word that gained prominence this year, and that's very much true. What I was interested actually in the research that the lexicographers did there was that vaping has actually been a term that's you can trace all the way back, I believe, to the early 1980s, before there really were even these electronic cigarettes, and it was still kind of a theoretical term that those people who were talking about the way that these cigarettes might eventually develop would lead to something called vaping, even though it didn't really exist yet. And now the reality has come to pass.
Does this also suggest that there's a disconnect between English as spoken in England and American English in terms of popularity and when words get picked up?
That may be true, but in a case like vaping, I'm not sure how that compares sort of UK versus US usage. But, you know, that's always the case where British usage may diverge from American usage in different ways, and some things may end up becoming popular on this side of the pond before it gets picked up over there. Although we do see with sort of increasing trends in globalization, very often particularly trendy words may catch on thanks to social media and so forth all over the place all at once.
You have the phrase God's view on your list. What does that refer to?
Right. Well, that had to do with the situation involving Uber, the ride-sharing service, which got a bit of unwanted publicity when it was revealed that employees had access to something called God View, which would be a display showing all of the real-time information of where people were going in their Uber cars. That's an interesting one that actually Jeffrey Nunberg selected as his word of the year on Fresh Air on the NPR show, where he tied it to this whole sort of new and creepy use of technology, sort of new opportunities for creepiness and God view for him really summed up that new trend.
But the word Uber came as a surprise to me. The last time I remember it being used in popular culture was when Saturday Night Live did a skit imagining what would have happened if Superman had landed in Nazi Germany. He would have been Uberman.
Well, of course, our own Superman comes originally from the Nietzsche term Übermensch, which George Bernard Shaw then sort of translated into English as Superman. But it's interesting how, that German term Uber, which could be an adjective or prefix in German, has increasingly been used in English as well, and it's even become a slang term where it just means something really great. You know, you can just use it as a standalone adjective now.
My guest is Ben Zimmer, the Wall Street Journal's language columnist, also the executive producer of Vocabulary.com. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Should we quickly address the questions of our listeners? Both of those words, of course, are nothing new. And I think we've been seeing political calculus for quite a while. But how does something like that suddenly become such common usage?
Yeah, that's interesting. Right. So, well, very often it has been common usage, but we just don't necessarily pick up on it. So what some linguists have called the recency illusion, we notice something and just assume that it must be new because we've just noticed it recently. Something like political calculus, I did a quick check and I'm finding it from the early 19th century. I see a speech by Edward Everett from 1830 talking about political calculus. And it's certainly something that's been increasingly common in terms of its usage over the past 50 years. I think that something like that, someone might pick up on it because it's an interesting use of a term that we associate with mathematics, making the leap into politics. But we see that with lots of terms. And certainly a word like optics, for instance, has really taken off over the past several years in its political usage. And that sometimes that kind of shift from one domain into another, from, say, science or mathematics into politics, can strike people as sometimes in an improper use of language if they don't like to see that kind of metaphorical transfer. But, these words, vortex, which we talked about previously, can often find a mainstream usage that is quite different from the more technical or specialist usage of the word.
Although we don't have political algebra. But along the lines of what you just said, Merriam-Webster, which uses a different approach, has chosen culture as their word of the year. Now, culture goes back even before political calculus.
Very true. Merriam-Webster takes a different approach from the American Dialect Society or other dictionary publishers, for instance, who name a word of the year. Simply, Merriam-Webster is looking just at an increase in lookups to their online dictionary. So apparently the word culture has been looked up in 2014 more frequently than it has been in past years, and we can think of various reasons why that might be. One thing that the lexicographers at Merriam-Webster have noticed is that the word culture ends up getting used in lots of different contexts. You know, for instance, blank culture. You can talk about gamer culture, or really anything can become a culture. And in fact, that word culture is a stand-in for what we used to call society. And so if you are taking a course in college, very often it would be about, say, African-American culture or something else with culture in the title. And that word society has been on the decrease while culture is on the rise.
You have both selfie stick and droney on your list, but I haven't seen either in practice during the past year. Am I hanging out with the wrong crowd?
Well, the droney, which is a selfie taken by a drone, also called a dronestagram, is not something you would necessarily see unless you were hanging out with people who are interested in drone photography, which is becoming more popular. The selfie stick, on the other hand, is very popular, in Asia in particular. It took off over the past year or so, and people will know what I'm talking about with the selfie stick as the retractable pole that you can put your smartphone on and take a selfie from a short distance without your arm getting in the way. That's popping up more and more. Another term for it is monopod. As the word selfie itself has become more common and sort of more mainstream, we have all of these derivatives like selfie stick that are now taking off.
And then we have dronies being actually wealthies, a selfie that's taken to prove one's wealth.
Right.
It's getting complicated here. Some things never seem to go away. Ever since Watergate, almost everything, every scandal has had gate attached to it, and now we have Gamergate.
That's right. The Gamergate was much in the news this year. A big controversy, a big kind of tangled mess of accusations and counter-accusations, starting off with the debate over ethics and video game journalism, but then it ended up devolving into kind of misogynistic harassment of women who are seeking more diversity in gaming culture. And there was a whole lingo that was associated with Gamergate and the Gamergaters, who very often saw themselves as battling against the SJWs, the social justice warriors. And so there was a kind of a whole lingo just associated with that controversy. The gate suffix itself, of course, as you say, is very common.
Will it ever go away?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it would only go away if there's something that took its place. One alternative that's cropped up in the past year or so comes from Benghazi, where just the Ghazi ending can get attached to things, usually in a lighthearted way or an ironic way. So instead of calling it Gamergate, you could call it Gamergazi.
Now, man has suddenly been attached to a whole bunch of words. Manspreading is a word that all New Yorkers have felt a need for. Susan suggests on Twitter also mansplaining as well as manspreading.
That's right. Mansplaining is one that we've seen. In fact, the American Dialect Society named it the most creative word of 2012. So mansplaining had its big moment a couple of years ago as a kind of patronizing way that men explain things to a female audience, and combining man plus the splain from explain. And interestingly, that has generated all sorts of other kinds of splaining as well. Right-splaining by people on the right wing, for instance, and lots of other variants on that theme. And manspreading takes the man prefix there, and, you know, perhaps mansplaining helps to explain the popularity of manspreading as a term this year, because it sounds a bit similar. But, you know, that's the phenomenon on on the subway when a man takes up two or even three spaces, spreading his legs in a V-shaped fashion. And the MTA in New York has you know, actually started an ad campaign trying to get guys to stop doing that. Of course, men are not completely responsible for that kind of space hogging, but they've become the target for this latest campaign.
Mansplaining, of course, goes all the way back at least until when Ricky used to explain to Lucy how things really worked. A couple of phrases I like, new ones, anonymish and normcore. Normcore, which finally gives my fashion sense its own categories. Anonymish, is that the best way we can hope for in terms of privacy and online culture?
Yes, it seems like nothing is truly anonymous, but there's been a lot of explorations in social media apps and so forth with things that are anonymish. So using that ISH ending to indicate that it's not quite anonymous. So things, for instance, may be recognized as coming from you or identified as coming from you among your own friends, but then anonymous to others, for instance. And anonymish is a nice example of the way that public and private divide is very fuzzy these days, especially when it comes to sharing things on social media.
Does anyone look at words that have either been lost or superseded during the year?
We tend to focus on the new and shiny, and so words that are lost do not get as much attention, and it's also more difficult to track that exactly. We can, of course, look back on previous years and words that were popular in previous years and see, well, that never caught on. And dictionaries themselves have to recognize that, too, sometimes when they enter a word in the dictionary and then may silently remove it when they need to make space for new words.
Well, they're popular as long as they're useful. For example, GAFA. But one of those companies might disappear somewhere down the line.
Right. GAFA is an acronym for Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, the big four companies that sort of dominate the Internet right now. And that acronym has been quite popular, especially in Europe and France, for instance, where there's a big concern about American cultural imperialism. And now we have cultural imperialism being exerted by these big tech companies. But, of course, those four companies aren't always going to be at the top of the heap. So it makes sense to describe our current situation. But, yeah, it very well may change in the near future.
No, it doesn't have to be a word. Global Language Monitor picked the heart emoticon as the word of the year.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice, and certainly emoticons and emoji have become a sort of a new kind of communication, and it'll be interesting to see if the American Dialect Society at its meeting in the first week of January decides to talk about emoticons and emoji. Certainly they don't fit into our traditional categories of Word of the Year. We may need to create a new category that might cover emoticons and emoji because they've become such an important element of our arsenal of communication when we're communicating online now.
Ben, thank you so much for being on our show. Ben Zimmer is the Wall Street Journal's language columnist and also the executive producer of vocabulary.com. We've been talking about the words of 2014.
Thank you.